Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting but not video streaming today from our studios in New York City. We're going to share the latest on, well, what happens when we take antibiotics and what that does to our immune cells and what that will do to oral infections. Also, antidepressants might contribute to antibiotic resistance. Two things that are interrelated but never discussed as they are joined in most of our medical procedures. A lot on health and healing today, but even more on the environment, including from the University of Washington, as temperatures rise, the bugs, the insects, will eat more of our food, and that means we're going to have a lot of crops that are not going to be available for humans. Also today, will extreme weather become even deadlier? I'll go into that. That's from a new study. At the time when Japan is flooding, the Carolinas are flooding, and we're not doing a damn thing about it. So I'll give you a commentary on that. Also, a full page in the paper this week about a teacher. Quote, "It's like my war-torn homeland and from one hell to another. Bosnian immigrant Adia is suing over allegedly being abused by her students in a school 143 in Washington Heights." I want to share her views. We have a lot of teachers in this audience. I'd like you to call in and share your points of view. In fact, all of our audio clips today are designed to get us to think differently or deeper than what we have. And I'll be going over those as we go through the show. And please, take the opportunity to call in. Our call-in number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I'm going to play three different clips. One is, the rich want to keep you dumb. Why do Americans hate intellectuals? Then, why gender confusion is an assault on young people, according to a person who engaged in that gender change and from a man to a woman, and now is going back to a man and has a lot of anger about what we're doing as parents without thinking it through, without looking carefully at what could be a normal process of life and not something that's hormonal. And then a surprising number of millennials will never get married. Well, so what? We're going to talk about that from a millennial point of view. As you see, we have a lot to share, as we do all the time, and always new every day. The first study today comes from Case Western Reserve University. And it's a study about antibiotics and how they destroy your immune cells and worsen oral infection. And with this research, they're showing that the body's own microbes are effective in maintaining immune cells and killing certain oral infections. And the team at Case Western Reserve University found that antibiotics actually kill the good bacteria, keeping infection and inflammation for longer periods of time. And so what we have to understand is when you take in antibiotics, in effect, you're destroying a lot of your good immune system, starting in the gut and going into the blood. And in the short term, that may be necessary. But if you look at what antibiotics do, they kill bacteria. They do not kill viruses. So if you have a substantial yeast infection, they could lower that. Neostatin would, without destroying your immune system. But what if you have a cold and flu? People take antibiotics. It's your immune system that you need to fight a cold and flu, so you need B. propolis and colloidal silver and olive leaf extract and quercetin and echinacea and astragalus and green tea. You need vitamin C and vitamin D. You need the omega-3 fatty acids. That's what fights a cold and flu, because all of those are antiviral, along with garlic and onions, but they also help build your immune system, along with probiotics. So the very thing we need the most, good probiotics and good bacteria, we're destroying when we take antibiotics. And tens of millions of Americans receive antibiotics each year for conditions that are actually made worse. Now, this is from Popular Science, and this is according to the CDC. About 13% of all Americans report taking antidepressants, and a stark increase from just 30 years ago, where just 1 in 50 Americans took such medication. At the same time, antibiotic resistance to infections are on the rise, causing about 700,000 deaths around the world every year, and it's increasing substantially. So the investigation focused on the drug fluoxetine, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor that addresses depression, supposedly by boosting the levels of certain chemicals like serotonin. Well, this drug, you'll know it as Prozac, is often prescribed to help patients recover from depression. But I've never seen anyone recover from depression using Prozac or obsessive compulsive disorder or bulimia or panic disorders. All of these they're given to. And for one simple reason, a primal reason, there has never been a study to prove, published in any scientific literature or presented at any scientific conference, that you have a brain chemical imbalance which can be measured, and then a drug applied that will rebalance that can be measured. There is no such science. Everything is based upon hypothesis, in effect, guessing. But we do know this, that if you ate sugar each day in the same quantity as you took an antidepressant medication, you would have about the same outcome, which means two things. One, that the actual drug is worthless, and two, sugar won't cause you to commit suicide in the amounts less than a teaspoon you'd be taking. And that has nothing to do with all the natural functional herbs and nutrients that can help with depression, like the B complex at higher doses, and St. John's wort, very effective at depression. But here's what happens. When you're taking a heavy drug, a drug that I believe should be banned, like Prozac, according to the test, showed that 30 days of exposure, just 1 month of taking Prozac, increases the rate of genetic mutations in E. coli, and that means that an antibiotic will be less effective, even if you needed one. So just something to think about. Now, I've suggested, in fact, not just suggested to the general audience, but for those 30,000-plus in our audience who've competed in New York City Marathon over the decades, and by the way, we're not doing it this year because, well, quite simply, I'm filming almost every day. I'm traveling. Next week it'll be in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in the Marcellus Shell area. We're filming people whose water is polluted and who are very sick because of environmental exposure to these gas hydrofracking wells. And then from there, I'm back to the city in the same day, and then off on the road again, excuse me, to film that going down south, or even stopping off in North Carolina to see the effects of all those hog farms when the flooding that's going on now, as much as 30 inches of rain in some areas to an already saturated ground, causes the animal waste to go into streams, estuaries, rivers, or down in time into wells, polluting them forever. Anyhow, we're filming all this. And I always tell people who do a marathon, but next year we are going to do the marathon. So just put that in your mind. The beginning next April, I'll be back in the city, and for 6 months, we will train people who want to walk, power walk, or jog, or run the New York City Marathon. Anyhow, I always tell people that how do we get through? Every single one of us have made it. No one has not. Starting at the six-mile mark, where everyone else is getting their caffeine drinks, we're not. We're taking cups of coconut water spiked with a generally it's either watermelon or a green or red powder. But there's something else, according to University of Putrajaya, Malaysia, published in the British Medical Journal's Comparing Alternative Medicine, coconut water and vinegar can treat liver damage. Now, vinegar made from coconut water has been commonly consumed in some cultures to treat disease like liver disorders and inflammation. In this study, coconut water vinegar was found to treat liver damage, and that's important. So, in fact, the coconut water vinegar started 7 days after the induction of a particular condition, and the research team measured each group's levels of oxidative stress and inflammation, compared the results, and hey, the treatment of coconut water vinegar for 2 weeks caused reductions in serum liver profiles, liver inflammation, and liver cytochrome P450 and 2E1, and that reduced the oxidative stress. So if you have hepatitis, if you have sclerosis of the liver, coconut water vinegar can make a difference. Cardiomyopathy, that kills a lot of people. It's reversible with coenzyme Q10 and selenium. New information out from GreenMedInfo. Now, cardiomyopathy, if you're not aware of it, cardio, that's your heart. Myopathy, that's like a fatty or weak heart, M-Y-O-P-A-T-H-Y. It's an example of a life-threatening medical condition in which complete recovery of cardiac function can be achieved using a nutritional supplement program in up to 70% of the cases. And it's not that difficult and certainly not expensive. Coenzyme Q10, which you all should know is your cardiac supplement. And I have to give credit to Dr. Steven Sinatra. I haven't spoken with him in a long time. He always impressed me as being a person of very high integrity. And he wrote a book, I believe it was around 1999, called Coenzyme Q10 in the Heart. And then he later had a bestseller called Metabolic Cardiology about combining coenzyme Q10 and D-ribose and L-carnitine. So it made a big difference on people's hearts. So we come to the subject of cardiomyopathy. And what we have found is that the combination of coenzyme Q10 with selenium, and I would add in zinc with that, can make an enormous difference. So remember, heavy metals accumulate in the heart muscle. A lot of people are not aware of that. You know, they accumulate in your liver, your kidneys, and your brain, the heart as well. And what they found is this same combination of coenzyme Q10 and selenium helps detoxify the heart. And there's strong anti-heavy metal processing with that. From our environmental segment, the warming oceans are changing the world's rainfall. A new study finds that warming in the Atlantic Ocean is changing rain patterns in the Amazon. And from The Guardian comes this story about global warming means truly global warming. The atmosphere, the oceans, and the ground are all heating up. As a result, ice is melting, seas are rising, storms are getting more severe, there is more rain released from storms, and droughts are getting worse. But these things are not happening in isolation. The tricky thing about the climate is that things are connected all across the globe. And those connections are revealing changes that may not be obvious at first glance. One such change was exposed in a recent paper published in the Journal of Environmental Research Letters by a team of top scientists from China and Brazil. An instructive video is also on this very same topic, and the scientists focused their study on the Amazon rainforest. There, the year is broken into wet and dry seasons, and the researchers wanted to know how rainfall has changed during the wet seasons over the past 20 years. What they found was astonishing. The rain in this tropical rainforest has increased about 600 millimeters. That's about 24 inches. They learned about the increase in wet season rainfall by reviewing old weather data and information from rain gauges, for example. And this study is really important for a few reasons. First, the Amazon is the most important of the entire globe's climate. The rainforest provides about 20% of the Earth's fresh water. There is a tremendous amount of evaporation from the rainforest into the air. And this evaporated water is carried to other parts of the planet where it falls as rain. We call the evaporation precipitation process the hydraulic cycle. So this cycle refers to the movement of water throughout the planet. And the Amazon is an important engine for the cycle. But the importance of the Amazon is broader than just water. The growth and decay of wood and plant growth there means the Amazon absorbs, like a sponge, and emits large amounts of carbon dioxide. Think of the rainforest as the lungs of the planet. They help the planet breathe. And the Amazon rainforest all helps transfer heat throughout the Earth's climate. Energy moves from one location to another with help of processes such as evaporation and condensation that originate in the Amazon. In these ways, the Amazon connects far-flung parts of the planet together. So what happens in one region like the Pacific Ocean affects the climate elsewhere like the Atlantic Ocean. So the way climate interacts between two distinct locations is called telecommunications. And the Amazon is the great teleconnector for the planet. Why do I say this? Because the Amazon is being deforested at a tremendous rate, like 1,000 football fields per hour, 24 hours a day. They're decimating that. And that is lessening the capacity to hold the carbon in the ground. We will pay a price for greed. We just don't know when and to what degree. Also, the strange science of melting ice sheets. Three things you didn't know. That a number of factors can bring about regional variations in sea level, such as change in ocean circulation or changes in land water storage. But the ice sheets are set to play an increasing big role. Why? The way they interact with gravity, the Earth's crust, and its rotation means they affect the oceans in a counterintuitive way. And here's how it begins. Gravity describes an object with mass attracting other objects to it. An ice sheet has a lot of mass, and so has a lot of gravitational pull on the water around it. This means the water level near an ice sheet is higher than it otherwise would be. As the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets melt, the pull of gravity is reduced. This, in turn, causes a drop in sea level around the ice sheets. The water has to flow somewhere, so the local drop is then balanced by the rise in sea levels on the other side of the Earth. This change in the Earth's gravity field results in a higher-than-average sea level rise at lower altitudes as the ice melts primarily near the poles. In addition, the solid Earth is still adapting to changes that happened at the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago. Big lumps of ice had pressed down on areas of the Earth's crust, particularly around the northern hemisphere. As these melted, the crust started to rise again. It's like a foam bed. When you sit up in the morning, the foam lifts up. So where there is a hole before, it's now basically back in shape. This process is called glacial isostatic adjustment, and it takes place over thousands of years. So that's what we're faced with. So ice melt changes how the Earth wobbles. That's not an insignificant fact because the Earth wobbles on its axis. And this can also impact regional variations as sea level rise. And so we have to limit all this to 2 degrees Celsius because if we don't, we will end up with a huge number of heat-related deaths. Millions a year will die if we pass that 2 degrees Celsius. And we're almost there. In fact, we looked at 451 locations in 23 countries that show overall we are going towards that place, and we'll probably be there in the very near future. So we should be conscious of this. And one last final thing on the environment. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, from the University of Washington, insect activity in today's temperature will impact agriculture regions, which will rise along with temperatures. And that could make it harder to grow crops for an ever-growing population. Quite simply stated, scientists have already warned that climate change likely will impact the food we grow. Now, I've mentioned this many times on the program. As the Arctic melts and as the oceans open up, without ice to reflect the sun back into the sky harmlessly, that sun will go down into the ocean, which is very, very shallow there, especially around Siberia, and it'll warm it up, and that historically thousands of years of frozen tundra and thousands of years of frozen shoreline and in the water, that's all going to melt. And as it warms, then huge amounts of methane are going to come up, and that will further increase global warming. And that means that the northern latitudes are going to have a hard time growing grains at the very least. And it doesn't all happen overnight, but it could happen within a year or two from now. You'll start to see rice and corn and wheat at about a 50% loss. It could go that high. Also, then you're going to have insects all over the place, because insects love to go where it's hot. And so when you hit 2 degrees Celsius in surface temperature, you're going to end up having, oh my goodness, hundreds of millions of tons of food eaten by insects and not humans. So as difficult as it is to grow something when the temperature rises in the soil, you're going to have insects that won't have any problem adapting. So what does come up, they're going to eat it first. So just remember, you at least knew about all this before anyone else. My hope is that you'll do something about it. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest in health nutrition. We're 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to read from a column. It's actually a full page, and then I'd like you to respond to it. And while you're thinking about responding to that, I'm going to one of our audio clips. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. This is a full page this week in the New York Post by Lorena Mongelli and Selim Algar, and it said, "The kids are all fight." Quote, "A Bosnian immigrant traded one war zone for another when she became a New York City teacher. Enduring years of racial, sexual, and physical abuse from her middle school students, a new lawsuit charges. Adia Sihic, S-E-H-I-C, 48, says rampaging kids broke her nose with a bag of metal rulers, stabbed her with a mechanical pencil, demanded sex acts, trashed her classroom, and hurled epithets at her, including white bitch. I was relieved when I came here because I was no longer worrying about the war. She had lost a relative during the Balkans ethnic strife in the early 90s. I thought I could have the ability to leave that behind. When the beaten-down teacher tried to appeal to the parents of one assailant, the kid mocked her, saying, 'When my mother comes in tomorrow, she'll deck you.' And the teacher says she repeatedly reached out for help from everyone, from school administrators to her union and cops, only to be targeted for termination because she sought help. In 2016, she was hit with a disciplinary charge from the City Department of Education in an effort to fire her for incompetence, she says. Meanwhile, her teen attackers were never removed from her class and rarely punished. The charges, quote, sought to blame her for unruly classes that resulted from the administration's failure to protect her. And she says she now has post-traumatic stress disorder from being in the classroom. So, wherever she went, she received no help, and instead, she herself was attacked. Let's pull back and accept that there are always going to be exceptions. There will always be the kid that's a bully. There will always be the parent that comes in and believes that no matter what the actions of their child, it's not the child's fault. That we all accept. But what if this is the new norm? Is this happening everywhere, or is this just happening in inner city schools? What's your experience? How would you handle this? What would you do if you were the teacher? And now add on to that, there's a whole new political correctness. There's identity politics, and the students are using the identity politics. For example, they talk about cultural appropriation. If you're one race and you came to school dressed in something that had been historically attributed to another race, that would be considered wrong because you're appropriating something from another race. It's gotten that bad. And especially at the elite schools, less so at the state schools. And also now, if you're a professor in colleges, I've taught in colleges my entire adult life. I don't know about high schools, though I have high school teachers who tell me it's bad there too. But you now must warn the classroom if you're to say anything that someone, even one person, may find unacceptable. Because now anything that a teacher says that can be considered unacceptable means the teacher can be brought up on charges like a star chamber and fined or even fired or disciplined. And they must apologize to the whole class for saying something that, for all intents and purposes, is not negative, it's not inaccurate. But now you must consider that every single student in every single class, in every single school, in every single level of education is a snowflake, incapable of handling anything that the parents have not conditioned them to accept as in an affront to their mental well-being. Now, how then do you teach anything? How do you talk about history except to blame everything on one group, no matter what the circumstances? Rewriting history and then social discourse. How do you have a conversation on social discourse? How do you have a conversation on politics or anything else? So I'd like your input. Give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Not just for this one teacher where nobody was supporting the teacher and nobody condemned the students, no matter how bad it was. And then imagine what would have happened had you gone up to a female teacher when you, like me, a baby boomer, were going to school and said, "Hey, teach, I just opened my zipper. You know what to do with that now, don't you? What do you think would have happened to us?" Let's see what you think on this. I'll save my thoughts so you can share yours. Now, I want you to hear this. We're going to start with this one about why gender confusion is an assault on young people, according to this particular person who is a transgender. But now he's coming back saying that they got it all wrong here, and we're causing a lot of children to undergo sexual transformation, sexual surgery, and hormone therapy who may have just been going through a normal process of life. And this is about bad parenting, not about a different child, in many cases. And that's what he's saying happened to him. What do you think? Listen in, please.
Or We're seeing so many young people spring up and identify as transgenders because we have this whole new social movement where people are pushing and shoving kids into identifying as a transgender just because a young boy plays with some girl's toy or a girl plays with a boy's toy does not at all mean that they're a transgender person. In fact, it's all children should be very curious about gender. Parents and adults, doctors and therapists, however, should avoid at all costs suggesting that a change of gender or hormone blockers or anything else is appropriate treatment. We know for a fact that if we leave the people alone, the young kids alone, and allow them to develop properly and affirm them in the gender that God gave them, then we have an opportunity to watch them grow through their early years, their teen years, and by the time they reach adulthood, they have no gender identity issues at all. It was just part of their developmental thing. So we're creating transgenders where they don't exist today by affirming them and encouraging them toward changing genders and giving them hormone blockers. And it's, frankly speaking, from my point of view as a former young child who did this, it's child abuse and it shouldn't be done.
Okay, that's an important social issue, and we believe in offering a forum and letting the audience give their input. You could accept or reject part or all of what he just said. This is a millennial explaining it.
In 1920, the median age American men got married was 24. For women, it was 21. And by 2016, it was up to 30 for men and 28 for women. What's more, 25% of millennials will likely never be married. So what the hell is going on with the world's oldest institution? Is marriage over? Give me your undivided attention and let's get wedgeducated. Before you start to panic, marriage isn't actually over, it's just over as we know it. It's not that millennials don't want to get married. In fact, 86% of them say that they want to tie the knot one day. But in true millennial form, they're taking their sweet ass time doing it.
Siri, how many people do I have left to swipe on?
You have 3 billion potential mates.
All right.
Remember that idea that you have to be married, have a home, and kids by the time you're 30? Well, people don't really believe in that anymore. Thank God. When it comes to marriage, we've been skeptics, even more so when it comes to choosing who we want to marry. In other words, we're being picky, and that's changing the way our culture thinks about marriage. The median age of Americans at their first marriage has increased significantly. So why are people getting married later or not at all? Well, it depends on who you ask, but no matter how you look at it, the trends are going against the old school way we looked at marriage. Take women, for example. For most of human history, women had to get married to keep a roof over their head. And we're not just talking about the Middle Ages. Banks were allowed to deny women credit cards if they didn't have their husband's consent until the 1960s. Crazy! But today, women are making more money than ever, which is making them less dependent on men for financial stability. Every 10% increase in women's wages leads to a 7% decline in marriage. Throughout history, proposals were always phrased to require a yes or no answer. But now, women have the leverage to say, later, maybe, or, oh, I wasn't looking at you, I was looking at your friend. Another group of people are the ones who say they just can't afford it. 27% of millennials say they would love to get married, but they aren't financially stable enough. You might be thinking that a quick courthouse wedding is pretty cheap. But when people think of marriage, they're not just thinking about their wedding. Many are considering everything that comes with it. Kids, buying a home, stuff that's expensive. And indicators do indeed show that millennials are financially struggling. More millennial households are in poverty than households headed by any other generation. And more than a fifth of millennials are living at home with their parents.
Good night, son. Good night, daughter-in-law.
Don't forget, neither of you have work tomorrow because my generation wrecked the global economy.
And having kids is something that Americans are doing less than past generations. In 1976, 65% of women had 3 or more kids. Today, two-thirds of all families now have two children or less, which, fun fact, means middle children are literally disappearing. But just because they're not getting married as quickly doesn't mean they're not living together anymore. People just don't feel like they need to get married before their significant other moves in. In fact, the number of unmarried couples cohabitating in the U.S. has increased 29% since 2007. And it's not just those rebellious young people signing up to share a cramped bathroom. The percentage of couples 50 years or older choosing to cohabitate is up by 75%. So yeah, people are making vastly different relationship choices, and for a variety of reasons. But there is one big indicator that they're doing pretty well. Divorce rates have been declining since the 1990s, and millennials are on track for the lowest divorce rates in decades. In fact, the divorce rate has dropped to its lowest point in the past 40 years. Why? Well, one theory is that it's because we're marrying later. In fact, a couple who gets married at 30 is less likely to get divorced than if they had gotten married when they were younger. So you might not be missing out on marriage, you might just be skipping your first terrible one. So the big question, is marriage over? Not really. It's just changing. Maybe we're just being smarter about it. Or maybe we're just being different. And being different than your parents isn't always a bad thing. No offense, Mom.
Of course, you could also add in, why would you want to marry most people knowing how absolutely screwed up they are? Would you go into a junkyard and try to find the least damaged total car as the one you're going to drive for the rest of your life? I don't believe we understand just how screwed up most people are. Whoa, the drama. So if someone says, let's be completely honest on our first date. I'm going to give the best of myself. I'm going to go to extra lengths to be groomed and nice and articulate. I've been coached in how to have a conversation. I paid a certain fee to what questions I should ask and which ones I should not. My facial mannerisms, my eye contact, all that's been coached. Doesn't come natural. And so once we get past a certain level and even of intimacy, then I'll become more relaxed and be able to show you who I really am. And there's going to be a lot of drama there, lots of arguments, lots of picking. I'm not going to say anything now, but later I'm going to make sure that you don't feel good about anything that you are, whether it's your hair, your makeup, your face, your suit, your jacket, your slacks, your job, your car. I can make you feel bad about everything. And you say, hold on a second. That's really who you are? Oh, yeah, that's who I am. That's who everybody is. If you're that desperate to go on these sites and fake your age and you're 57, you're saying you're 47 and you look 97 and your teeth are in your front pocket and you're gumming it, maybe you stop lying for a moment. But you can't, because then you might get someone your own age, and heaven forbid that you get someone within your own age group. So, and this is how it begins. Did you ever think that maybe people are just getting wiser today, that they don't have to live by these stupid rituals from the past? Okay, you're a certain age, go out, get married, doesn't matter who. And, you know, and think of those countries where you have no choice. It's an arranged marriage. Your parents found the person for you. You've got to marry him, and somehow you're supposed to adapt and live heavenly ever after. That doesn't happen. So we maladapt to a tolerance level. And it's almost like saying, today I'm only taking 7 aspirins to kill the pain from sitting on this tack. It used to be just 1. Tomorrow it may be 9 aspirins. Why don't you just get off the tack? Well, I can't do that. What would everyone think? Everyone has expectations of me. They don't want me to disappoint them, and I don't want to disappoint them. So the longer we don't disappoint them, the more we give the illusion that somehow we're okay. So what about those people who'd rather be alone and be happy with themselves than with someone and constantly having to adapt to someone else's moods and how they feel and their own self-absorbed narcissism, where every single conversation is about them and their story? And what if they're a victim of something and they can't get over being a victim? So every moment's about, you know, helping them, which they're never going to help themselves. There's a lot of reasons people are not getting married. Now, because she's a millennial, I'm willing to say you're giving us a perspective from your generation's point of view. Good for you. And you could be right on each of those points. I'm just giving you a perspective from someone who's been around a little longer and is looking at a deeper reason why a lot of people just don't want the hassle anymore. Men and women don't want the hassle. and don't want to have to maladapt to someone else just to be able to get through a day. Those days are over. And then one day you realize, my God, I don't get a second chance at this. Life isn't a dress rehearsal. I've got to pay attention. And then you do. And then a lot of things and a lot of people that you've allowed in your life, you won't anymore. And then you wonder why did I ever allow that person in my life? Man, they became one big horror show. Well, because more often than not, we were adapting to everyone else's expectation of us. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. It is my belief that the average person is not going to do anything at any time to protect themselves against some natural occurring disaster. And I was going to do a little commentary. I want to read this little commentary. I wrote it. It's just the beginning. Here's what I wrote this morning. Tens of millions of Americans do not believe in global warming, or they deny that climate change is being driven by human activity. Others accept the consensus from the vast majority of scientists in the international community that anthropogenic climate change is real. However, most do not fully understand it. This confusion is also true for the majority of elected officials and legislators who are expected to make wise decisions. Consequently, during the past 40 years, virtually nothing constructive has been done to effectively mitigate the consequences of our lifestyles and habits and addictions that may slow global warming trends. Americans continue to demand more stuff, more gas-guzzling SUVs and trucks and planes and meat and poultry and fish and milk and cheese and genetically modified crops and all the pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers that accompany them. Demand for hardwood, for more furniture, sand for manufacturing concrete, more coal-powered plants, hydro-fracking and oil drilling. All of this stuff is necessary to sustain the neoliberal myth of infinite progress that fuels booming and emerging economies. What is not being asked is, what are the consequences of the choices I make? Do I choose paper or plastic at the checkout counter? Shall I purchase water in a glass or plastic bottle? A hamburger or a veggie burger? Will I make an effort to buy only organic produce, or doesn't it matter? As a result, during just the last 2 years, the global warming's increase has included some of the worst climate events and news in recorded history. Among the major climate environmental news headlines that convey the severity of our planet's weakening immune system are, and just a sample, the Earth's carbon concentrations have soared to levels not seen in 800,000 years. Summers are getting hotter faster, especially in North American farm belt. New study shows Antarctic melting approaching unstoppable tipping point. The price to be paid for not cutting emissions and greenhouse gases could mean driving the planet across the planetary boundaries or tipping points. Global glaciers melting up to 3 times the rate of the 20th century. Surge in methane emissions threatening efforts to slow climate change. This melting glacier in Antarctica could raise sea levels by 11 feet. Climate change could flip Mediterranean lands to deserts. Scientists are clear. Big winter storms influenced by warming planet. New York City can expect 9 feet floods as common. Almost biblical. Amazing 3,000-foot-high dust cloud shrouds that just recently Phoenix. 3,000-foot-high, 30 miles wide, blanketed all of Phoenix. Unprecedented mass die-offs in the Pacific Ocean, turning the ocean into a desert off the California coast. California is turning its back, and as a result on this, it's becoming a desert with no contingency plans. The U.S. faces floods of climate refugees. The U.S. coastal flooding breaks records as sea levels rise. according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Unprecedented heat waves fueling Arctic fires make more than twice as likely by climate change. Antarctica's ice loss tripled in the last 5 years, also raising sea levels. The hottest July, August on record in the United States. California's Death Valley busts its own record, with the 2018 on track to be the hottest year ever recorded. NASA scientists say ocean circulation is slowing, and we should all be very concerned when that happens. Europe's extreme summer is so hot it melted the highest peak in Sweden, and now it's only the second highest. NOAA's State of the Climate report confirms the planet has entered the new neighborhood of global temperatures. Humankind has already disturbed or degraded 6/7 of the blue planet, and heat wave deaths will rise substantially. And the grotesque truth about Florida's red tide disaster, Lake O'Green algae dumps to blame. And methane, a death trap threatens democracy. These are the things we're dealing with right now as I speak. And yet collectively these headlines, among many others which could have been included, describe the new normal. We can reasonably expect Category 4 and 5 storms and hurricanes annually. There is no evidence that wildfires across the American West Northwest will reside or subside, and prolonged droughts will persist. These environmental trends and more should force us to concede that humanity is on a course to exceed its capacity to sustain a quality of life throughout much of the world, including half the United States. If we think it over and are honest about it, then we've already created 30 million war refugees. That's the United States alone. Conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and then tens of millions more refugees from internal displacement in their own land. And if that's not bad enough, just imagine the reality of 300 million people around the world who now wait in line to become climate environmental refugees in the future. Extreme storms, floods, hotter weather, not able to grow food, not able to drink water. That's the new reality. And yet, there are nations and major cities around the world taking climate change seriously. Visionaries and scientists are creating unique and wonderful innovations in renewable energy to challenge America's hubris and denial and complacency. And rather than descending into apathy and withdrawing into isolation and being unwilling to face these problems, we today must put our intents forward to provide deep and detailed strategies for how we as individuals and groups collectively can make a difference. After all, if 5% of America's population are truly progressive and on point, then we can help in our own way save our own lives as well as helping make a difference for the planet. I just wanted to share that with our audience because on the one hand, I am an optimist for those of us who are willing to be honest about our lives. And I'm not an optimist for all the rest who simply shrug their shoulders, say, so what? And, you know, we'll get by. And the answer is you will not get by. And maybe at some point in the future, when you look back and think of all the information you had, all the warning signs you should have heeded, all the times you should have taken advantage and moved, sold, got out of debt, and you chose not to because you didn't want to disturb your comfort level, sooner or later, we all pay a price, a good price for the good choices and a bad price and bad karma for the bad choices in our lives. So for those of you who would like to get the Gary Null filter, at least so you know that you've got something, if you never use it, good. I hope you don't use it. But if you do have to use it, as I have, as I'll be using it next week. I'm even taking some extras because I know some families that can't drink their water and they can't move. And they're in debt, and they're sick. And now I'd like to address a lot of people's concerns, as we did a couple weeks ago when we told you about the statements being made about a particular nutrient, that they were wrong, and I gave you tons of examples of how that was taken out of context. Well, today, the same thing. People are saying, I just read, Gary, that no good comes from taking probiotics. There's some study that said that. Simply not true. Here's the truth, and here's why so many people in the media really should put things in their proper context and simply be honest. Researchers with the Weizmann Institute of Science in Tel Aviv found probiotics are essentially useless after feeding a probiotic blend of 11 good bacteria, such as lactobacillus and bifidobacteria, to 25 healthy volunteers for a month. They then analyzed the samples from the subject's stomach and small intestines to see if any of the strains had colonized or altered the activity of the gut. Half the time, the good bacteria were excreted uneventfully. Otherwise, they lingered briefly before being crowded out by the existing gut microbiome. A doctor there interpreted the results to mean that probiotics cannot be used in a one-size-fits-all fashion, that they must be tailored to the human host to be effective. I would agree with that. Now, here's what's wrong with the study. It's only 1 month. It's only 25 people. And here's what's worse. These were all healthy subjects. Well, if you're a healthy subject, you have good probiotics in your system. Now, had they had all sick people, people with candida, people who have been drinking, people who might have had toxic diets, then that probiotic would have really made a difference. All the time I see people who I'll give them billions of probiotics who've been on a standard American diet eating pizzas and hot dogs and hamburgers and french fries and alcohol and pretzels and bread and potato chips, and they're a mess. They have high blood pressure and high blood sugar. They're overweight. They have diabetes or prediabetes. They frequently might even have cancers in their body. So they have a very toxic intestine. And I'm dealing with tens of thousands I've counseled. And then one of the first things I do is put them on a cleansing detoxification program. Now, that generally takes a year. Now, you see results earlier. And the more you cleanse and detoxify, the more bad foods you take out of the diet, you're allowing for the body to rebalance its chemistry. Now, when you start rejuvenating the body, giving it all the right fruits and vegetables and herbs and functional foods and juices, then you see a real increase in good health. And, of course, a part of that is every day, twice a day, unless a person has been on a whole protocol of antibiotics. And how many Americans do you know who've been on antibiotics? How many children have been on antibiotics? That kills the bacteria. That kills the good bacteria, so only bad bacteria end up multiplying. So you see, the study should have had another group of individuals. It should have had, first of all, should have had at least 100 individuals, 100 who are sick with different conditions, including candida, and 100 who are completely healthy, and then measured the two groups. But they're saying, well, you should give antibiotics specifically. I agree with that. But still, if we start getting a whole country to eat more probiotic foods, then they're going to be healthy. So when probiotics are given for specific health conditions, it should be specific. A dietitian, a nutritionist, a physician who's experienced in probiotics should help you. But here's what the public should also know. PubMed, the government's own official scientific site, has 19,167 studies on the beneficial effects of probiotics. These are the compounds found in fermented foods, and they have anti-carcinogenic, antimicrobial, antifungal, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties. They're also anti-diabetic, anti-atherosclerotic, and anti-hypertensive. That's according to critical reviews in Food and Science. And then there are just so many studies, over 19,000. So the science is there to support the fermentation of food, from miso on to beets and sauerkraut. So take your probiotics. But if you have specific health conditions, then your probiotics should be better tailored, because how much probiotics you receive will depend upon how much your body needs to rebalance itself. Hope I put that little myth to bed now. So there's good science, phenomenal science, thousands of studies, 19,000 studies showing probiotics are good for you. But wherever possible, tailor them to your specific needs. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.